Welcome today to the interview series with Outstanding Professional. I am Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with the eminent and celebrated computer scientist and visionary innovator, Dame Wendy Hall, professor of computer science at the University of Southampton in England, and the first non-North American president of the Association of Computing Machinery. Dame Wendy, you have a long history of notable distinction, significant outstanding contributions in a number of fields, including societal causes. Thank you for sharing your considerable expertise, deep accumulated insights, and wisdom with our audience.
Well, thank you very much for interviewing me. You make me sound very old and eminent, and it's a bit like those Lifetime Achievement Awards when people win and they say, hang on, I haven't finished yet. So anyway, it's a pleasure to be talking to you today.
So when did you hear of this extraordinary honor, a knighthood as Dame Commander or DBE, and how do you feel at this time, and the reaction from your family?
It's the equivalent of a knighthood for women, so it's actually a dameship, I'm told, which sounds even worse, but anyway. You get a letter from the Prime Minister of the UK about 6 weeks before the announcement, asking you if the Queen is minded to give you this honour, if you'll accept, because obviously they don't want to announce names, but some people do turn them down. And then you're told if you do accept, you have to keep quiet for 6 weeks, which is very hard. So I told a very, very few people, just very close family, really. And I went to Australia for Christmas, and the list is published on New Year's Eve in the London Gazette. And it was about 10 o'clock in the evening in Sydney when the news broke in the UK. The newspapers started calling me. And as you know, Sydney's very well known for its fireworks. And so there I was, drinking champagne, waiting to see the Sydney fireworks and talking to the press about becoming a dame. And it was really quite surreal, but thrilling, I have to say, very thrilling. It's something I never dreamt I would achieve. You know, I come from a very modest background and the first in my family to go to university, and I never dreamt I'd achieve anything like this.
And the reaction from your family?
Well, you can imagine. There's never been a dame in my family before. And, yeah, they're just thrilled for me. I think, again, it doesn't seem real. They can't quite understand what it means, except that it's a great honour.
While you continue to make significant historical contributions, how will your new status contribute to your vision for the world, society, industry, academia, and technology?
Well, I don't really know yet. I've only been a dame for 3 weeks. Everyone tells me that it will enable me to open doors I maybe couldn't have opened before. I mean, for me, it's more of the same, really. It's a great starting point for conversation with people outside the UK, because people outside the UK don't really know what a dame is. In New York, it means something very different to what it does in the UK. And I can't tell you how many people have sung that song to me, which I'm sure you can guess. But I think that it will enable me to continue what I'm doing, but at a higher level, possibly, in terms of policy, you know, to actually lobby at a higher level and to get in to have meetings with very senior figures who might be able to influence our community and, you know, the world that we are trying to work in.
So what do you see, then, as the top three challenges facing us today, and how do you propose they be solved?
The top three? Oh, that's hard. I think the most important one is that people don't understand the impact that computers have had on the world. They understand that computers are sort of behind everything that, you know, a lot of the changes in the world, but they don't understand that that's ongoing. And that actually the people who have built the computers and developed the software and built the networks and designed the software that runs on the networks and the social networking that happens on that, that those are amazing achievements and that they're ongoing, and that the people who do, you know, the engineers and the scientists who do this work are an incredibly important community. And I think people just take it all for granted. The world I live in, the world I work in, the world of the internet and the web, people use that without governments and businesses and people use it for social networking, and they really don't understand what it is they're using. They sort of, you know, when you turn on a tap, you sort of understand that somewhere there's a reservoir of water and there's a company that somehow makes that water, arranges for that water to arrive in your house. But and when you flick a switch, somehow you understand that there's a power plant that's generating that electricity. But people don't understand when they use the web what it is and where it came from. And I think that our profession is undervalued because of that. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, absolutely. So you're talking about just sort of raising the profile of the profession and also of the IT professional as well.
Absolutely. And so that, you know, that I think is my top one to get across, and to get across to young people that this is a really exciting world. And I would set it in the context of science and engineering generally. In the developed world, the numbers of young people that we're attracting to study science and engineering and to work in that world are falling all the time. And it's sadly, we're even seeing it in the Far East now as well, where and, you know, you want to get across the message that actually you can change the world by being a scientist or an engineer. And so that's the bigger message. And being a computer scientist or an IT professional is a really exciting part of that. So those are really my top two. And I guess my third one is reaching out to women and saying, hey, you know, this is a world you need to be part of. And it is, you know, working with computers, you can do things that will really help people. You know, the health and innovations in healthcare, and the innovations in social care, and innovations in education. You know, these are things that excite women, and computing is a big part of that.
You know, increasingly there is attention being given to IT as a profession with recognized professional certification and adherence to a code of ethics, demonstrated professional development, alignment with the body of knowledge and best practices. These concepts are encapsulated in IT professionalism. Can you share your views on IT professionalism?
I think it's very important that our profession is recognized in the way other professions are. When I was president of the British Computer Society in, it was 2003, 2004, we were just developing a really adventurous IT professionalism program. And in the UK, the British Computer Society and others have joined together to create the CITP, which is the Chartered IT Professional Qualification. That's a very UK take on the subject, but I think it's so important that our profession is recognized in that way. And I, you know, every country will do it differently, but the more we pay attention to this, then I think the more respect we will earn from the world, and then an understanding that you know, to be an IT professional takes training, and we should have a code of ethics and professional practice just like any other profession.
So it's interesting that the IFIP organization has launched a global certification program in 2009 that ties in all the different kinds of society. So it's very much in line with this idea of IT professionalism.
Yeah, and I, you know, there's lots of routes to, I mean, I'm an academic and I'm interested in, I've spent many, my career thinking about computer science degrees, and, you know, many of our graduates will go out and work in the IT profession, but there are many different routes to the IT profession. And I think that makes it different in some ways to accountancy or medicine, where you really have to have that degree in that subject area to be a profession in that area. There are many different routes to IT professionalism, which I think is why it's important that the societies, the learning societies, and the organisations that are interested in this are out there leading in terms of what it is to be an IT professional. These are the sorts of things you need to have done to be able to say that you are an IT professional. This is the code of conduct you need to sign up to.
You know, you have this amazing series of initiatives that you're involved with. So can you tell us more about your vision and the objectives behind your current roles and what you hope to accomplish and how you will bring this about.
My current roles are many and varied. I'm obviously very excited to be president of the ACM. I'm very proud of the fact, you know, that I'm the first person from outside North America to be president of the ACM, and that the ACM community voted for somebody outside the US to be president. Because actually you can, with an international organization like the ACM, you can feel that you are making a contribution to the international community. And one of the major things I'm involved in, one of the reasons I stood, was the internationalization agenda that the ACM has in terms of, it has a global membership, and it has its publications and its conferences. What is the offering apart from that to members outside of North America, particularly India, China, and in fact, rather ironically, Europe, which I find them, but vaguely amusing in the sense that, this is the country I live in, the zone I live in, and we're thinking about what does the ACM do for me. But it's terribly important because a lot of the work is sort of happens in the US, and it's very important that we have an offering for members outside the US that gives them something meaningful in their region. So that's very important to me. And of course, of my several other hats, most important to me is my research and the new Web Science Research Initiative that I set up with Tim Berners-Lee and Nigel Shadbolt and Danny Weitzner in 2006, which is all about saying to people, hey, this amazing thing that's changed the world, this very complex system, the web, that is not just technology, because it's all about how people use it, and we don't understand why things grow, why it grows, and what are the triggers that make some things happen and others not, and what's its impact going to be in the future on society. You know, so that is really my first priority in terms of research, and it's quite exciting to launch a new research discipline and have people take notice of you. And generally, I enjoy the policy work. I enjoy work, advising UK government and being on the Scientific Council, the European Research Council. It's a way to shape things, and I find that very stimulating.
You know, there was a study done in 2006 from Microsoft Research where there's a prediction that the proportion of the world's engineers and scientists living in Asia by 2010 is 90%. What are the long-term implications of this situation?
Well, actually, that study was done before the current financial crisis, and I'm not sure what would happen if it was redone now. I think we're living in very unpredictable times. One thing's for sure, we will need people with IT skills going forward, and I think every country, whether it's the developed or the developing, needs people with IT skills. And I think that we have a unique opportunity actually with this crisis, as we've often said in the past that we train some of our brightest people in science and engineering, and then they go and work in the city. There won't be jobs for them in the city, so I'm hoping very much that we will attract some of that talent back into the science and engineering pool, because there's an amazing amount of work still to be done. It will be ongoing. And I think that governments in the developed world understand that the way out of this crisis is, we've used the phrase, when I did a launch at the Royal Academy of Engineering a couple of weeks ago of our new diversity campaign, we used the phrase, we need to engineer ourselves out of this recession. And I think that's a very important phrase to remember, that actually what we need are people who can innovate. And so I think there is a unique opportunity to say, these are the sorts of skills we need our young people to have going forward. So I there's certainly lots of people going into IT in the developing world and the Far East. But I think the balance will shift back again, actually, just out of necessity.
I guess so. What you're really saying is, and it sort of very much aligns with the Job Migration Task Force, where they conducted a two-year study which clearly indicates that to stay competitive in a global IT environment and industry, countries must adopt policies that foster innovation and improve their ability to attract, educate, and retain the best IT talent.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I was never, as far as I was concerned, I was never one of the gloom and doom merchants with the job migration, because I think that these things ebb and flow, and there was always going to be a pushback. And I think that the financial crisis is forcing governments to think. You know, there's been a change of government in the U.S. I know the government in the U.K. Is saying it's still going to fund science and engineering because it sees that as hugely important, despite the fact that we've got these dreadful problems with the banking infrastructure, because that's the only way to stay strong.
So again, you know, you have this incredible position and just a remarkable history of accomplishment. Can you make your predictions for the future, their implications, and how business executives and IT professionals can best prepare?
Can best prepare for the future?
Yes, that's right.
Well, I've long thought that businesses have been run too much by accountants and, you know, the people who are driving the finances, and we now know that many of those that way of running a business isn't necessarily the way to success when it all goes horribly wrong. Fine, when there's plenty of money around, that to be the driver, and businesses have very much been driven to please the shareholders. And I think that in the future, what needs to happen is that we need more scientists and engineers involved in running the businesses. I'm not saying that every scientist or engineer will want to be a manager or on a board of directors, but I think that businesses will need more people with an understanding of where the world is going and the understanding of innovation on the board. And so I think what I always say to people is, you must be a professional, but actually, you must look really high. You must look to be at the top of the company. And I think that, you know, that I think that for too long, you know, people, the scientists and engineers, have their career progression has stopped when they're head of IT or head of research or whatever, and actually they should be up there on the board running the companies. Many of our universities now, the vice chancellors and the presidents come from science and engineering. And I think this has got to be true for big business as well. I mean, companies are often founded by scientists and engineers, or founded by innovation that comes from science and engineering. And then somehow that gets lost when you get, you know, you go public and you get shareholders, and suddenly it's the finance people that run the company. And I think we might see a shift away from that, especially when we have a lot of people who, as I say, with science and engineering degrees have been working in the city, they're now going to be looking for new jobs and new career progression, and I'm hoping we can encourage them to use their science and engineering skills.
So that's very interesting, and that's sort of, you're providing a path for IT professionals and technologists and engineers and scientists to consider leadership roles in organizations and business and so on.
Absolutely, and I would advise everybody, I've been on two or three really good leadership courses, and if people are interested in this, then go on leadership courses. Go and learn how to do it. I mean, you need a bit of natural skill in there as well. It doesn't mean you have to be tied down with management details too much. I mean, it's actually about leadership and vision, and we need a lot of that at the moment. And our IT professionals need to be in there doing that, because we can see what's coming down the track in terms of, you know, the next generation of technology.
And I guess an added opportunity would be to volunteer for the Association of Computing Machinery or other associations and societies, and perhaps take a leadership role within those organizations as well.
Yeah, well, you know, each to their own, and some people are joiners and some people aren't. I'm a networking person, and I have always enjoyed being part of networks that can make a difference. And the bigger the network you're involved with, the more it can make a difference. And I think, I think if you have organizational leadership skills, then you should get involved with whichever organization or society most attracts you, because that's a way to give back, you know.
And I did an interview with Bill Miller, and he's in the Silicon Valley Hall of Fame. And he indicated that one of the best ways that you can learn how to run any kind of organization is to volunteer for a professional society or user group or other kinds of volunteer organizations.
Oh, absolutely. It all hones your skills. Yeah.
Can you comment on the burgeoning China-based market and also in India?
Comment, yes. I'm doing quite a bit of work in China at the moment. We have at Southampton, a collaborating with Tsinghua University, which is one of the top universities in China based in Beijing, to set up a web science research lab at the Tsinghua Graduate School in Shenzhen, which is, if you don't know, just on the south coast near Hong Kong, in mainland China. And so I'm learning a bit more about how the technology is being used in China. And of course, it's amazing how quickly they have adopted and adapted the technology. And the amazing thing is that there, I think it might have already happened, there are more people on the internet in China than in America now. And there's only 20% of the Chinese population that has access to the internet in the big cities. So there's a lot more to go there. And I think, like a lot of the developing world, the rural parts of China, like Africa and rural India, and will access the web and the internet through mobile phones. And that's a very exciting development for the future, because they won't know the web as we know it. They will know it. It will be different. The mobile web on handheld device will be different, and there'll be a lot of innovation there and lots of new things that we won't have thought of. So it's very exciting to see how different cultures use the technology. And as I say, the one I'm becoming most familiar with is China. Of course, I can't read a word or speak a word of Mandarin, and we have to understand when we do a search using Google or whatever our favorite search technology is, that we're only seeing a tiny fraction of what's on the web, the English part of it. There's much more Chinese out there and other languages. And I think it's really, when we talk about collaborating with these other countries, you know, it's so hard to, we can't read what the papers they've written in their languages, the patents, the discussion, we can't follow the discussions online. And I think we've got to break down those sorts of barriers if we're really going to collaborate. In India, it's slightly different because they tend to work in English, and so you can follow, and it's a different type of culture, and they're working very hard to get the internet out into rural India. And something that a lot of people also are looking at, how access to the web could change the lives of people in the poorest parts of Africa if we can get them mobile phones in ways that they're never going to be able to have the laptops if they haven't got the electricity or the infrastructure for the landline phones. So, you know, if you go to South Africa, they've all got mobile phones there. And, you know, we can use that in ways to really empower people. And it will be a different world when, you know, we think of social networks today and how there are no barriers between people around the world. Everyone can talk. But it's actually only the developed world. You know, imagine what it's going to be like when we're on a social network with people in Africa who have nothing. It's going to be an interesting for us to we might be able to engage with these people. At the moment, we see them on our television sets, but actually, you know, it's going to maybe make the world a bit more equal, a bit more level. Sorry, my English is bad there. So I think we're going to see amazing changes in the world over the next 20 to 30 years as the technology develops.
I guess this ties into the fact that there's, 4 billion mobile phones today, and you even have social networking communities. I think in China there's one QQ messaging service. There's 800 million users of that service. It's just incredible.
Yeah, it's incredible. Numbers we don't conceive of. And it will be interesting to see how much, as I say, it makes the world more equal and how much it silos it, because, again, language is going to be a big, language and culture is big issues here.
But I understand at Tsinghua University that 60% of the courses now are taught in English. So.
Yeah, they do. It's still, yes. And, of course, whenever we give lectures out there, we speak in English at the universities, yeah, they understand that they need to get people to speak English to make their way in the world, but you don't know how that balance is going to shift. Perhaps we'll all have to learn to speak Mandarin in the future, I don't know.
You know, Dame Wendy, you're continually selected as one of the top researchers and senior academics and groundbreaking visionary innovators. How do you wish to continue to shape the world and contribute to the fabric of history?
Gosh, you make that sound so grand. I just do what I enjoy doing, actually. I'm lucky that I have organizational and leadership abilities, I think. And I sort of have a vision of where I think the future is going to take us, and I try to get involved with research that's going to make a difference, I suppose. There's no magic. I all I can say to people is that you should enjoy what you do. I mean, I'm passionate about some of the things that I do, and I guess that's what drives me forward. I'm lucky. At the moment, I have my health and a lot of energy and a very supportive family, and I enjoy meeting people and I enjoy traveling. And, you know, I'm not going to want to do that forever, but while I'm enjoying it, I will. And I have always, in my career, I can remember at the very beginning of my career when I was working what we now call multimedia. In those days, in the 80s, the concept of pictures on computers was just something very off the wall, and people told me that I wasn't doing computer science and that I really should be getting into writing compilers or building operating systems, and I guess I was just pig-headed enough, and I had enough good support and a good mentor, and I kept going with it because I thought it was something that was going to become important. And I think it's just about sticking with your instincts and don't let people put you off. If you think that it's the right thing to do, then do it.
Well, we're coming near to the end of our interview and just have a couple of more questions. You know, we have a unique opportunity to drill into the accumulated wisdom from an accomplished executive and thought leader. If you could sum up your life experiences with a few career tips for IT professionals, what would be your tips and the reasons behind them?
Well, I think I've said most of it. I mean, don't let people put you off. If you're, if you feel strongly about something, then or that you want to do something, then try and do that. Enjoy what you do. Somebody once said to me, work is only hard work if you don't enjoy it. And I've tried very hard in my career to make sure that I've always looked forward to getting up and going to work every day. Now, some people, it's not possible to do that. I think that you always need to be a little bit of your own boss somewhere along the line. You need to have a bit of space to do what you want to do. And I hope employers, Google has set an interesting trend here. Other employers should listen to that. It's easier in a university because we're paid to innovate and think about the future, and that's what our job's about. But and I think also, as I said, aim high. Don't think, oh, I'm an IT professional, I've got to live in this basement forever. Look up and think, I could do that.
You know, Dame Wendy, we're now going to sort of turn the tables, and if you were doing this interview, what two questions would you ask, and then what would be your answers?
What two questions would I ask? And I've got to answer it as well.
Yes, that's right.
I think that seems unfair. Two questions would I ask? What time's tea? And the answer is now, because someone just bought me a cup. Being serious, what would I ask? Yeah, that's an extremely hard one. You mean, what would I ask me?
Or what sort of areas would you think that I should have asked you, but did not?
What do I do to enjoy myself? Well, I suppose I've sort of answered that, because, as I say, this idea that work's only hard if you don't enjoy it. I try and enjoy everything I do, but I do have some downtime, and I love shopping, and I love travelling, and I enjoy my holidays, and lots of people ask me how I got into computing, so that's all documented. Where do I get my energy from? I don't know. I think I'm one of those very lucky people that doesn't need much sleep.
Well, Dame Wendy, with your demanding schedule, we are indeed fortunate to have you come in and do this interview with us. And thank you for your sharing your substantial wisdom with our audience.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. It's been my pleasure. And I look forward to hearing what I said.
I am Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with the eminent and celebrated computer scientist, Dame Wendy Hall, professor of computer science at the University of Southampton in England, and the first non-North American president of the Association of Computer Machinery.